You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 453. Remember, it costs nothing to encourage an artist, and the potential benefits are staggering. A pat on the back to an artist now could one day result in your favorite film or a cartoon you love watching or a song that saves your life. Kevin Smith.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Well, guys, you are in for a treat today. As promised, I'm bringing to you an icon of the 90s independent film scene. Today's guest is Scott Mosier, the producer of the indie film classics Clerks, Mallrats, Chasing Amy, Good Will Hunting, Dogma, and many, many more. It was truly a treat to talk to Scott and ask him questions about what it was like to be there at the beginning, essentially, of the independent film movement as we know it today. I mean, Clerks is one of those just legendary films in the independent film world. And to talk to somebody who was there as it was being made, what their mindset was, how they got it made, his backstory of film school and how he really fell into this whole thing with Kevin and kind of going on that journey with Kevin Smith. And then also we discuss how he's transitioned into being a director in his own right, where his last film, The Grinch, grossed $500 million in the worldwide box office, and how he got into animation and so much more. This is just such a wonderful, wonderful conversation, and I can't wait to share it with you guys. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Scott Mosier. I'd like to welcome to the show the legendary Scott Mosier. How are you doing, Scott?
The legendary Scott Mosier is not here.
Well, then we'll just deal with the Scott Mosier that's in front of us.
Yeah, Scott Mosier is here. I don't know about the legendary, but I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. Thank you so much for coming on the show, man. I've been a fan of your producing for a long time and your directing. My kids are now fans of your directing as well, which we'll get all into that in a bit. But you know, many of my listeners know that you know, kind of got your start in Clerks, working with Kevin and getting that whole thing going. I have to first tell you, when I first saw Clerks, because you and I are similar vintage as far as age is concerned.
So you're looking at, I'm about to, what's today? Friday, on Friday, I'm a week So today is February 24th. So March 5th, I turned 50. I'm wow. like,
so
yeah.
You're a little bit, you're just slightly a bit older. I'm 46. So we're in similar, we've crossed over the yeah. same bodies in the business. So when I first saw Clerks, I was so upset because I was working in a video store. I was just like, it was right in front of me. Why didn't I think of this? It was like literally, I worked at a video store for 5 years and I was just like, God damn it, man. I was so upset at myself. I'm like, why hadn't I thought of that? But you guys did it. So how did you get involved with Kevin? How did you get involved with Clerks and that whole kind of crazy story?
So, I mean, you know, I backing it up, it's like I was probably, I guess I was like 14 or 15 or even younger than that. It was like Raiders of the Lost Ark was the movie I saw where it wasn't just that I was like, oh, I love this movie. It was more that I was like, oh, how do people do this? Like, you know, that it's a constructed thing, you know, like I became aware that it's like, oh, people made it. It didn't just appear out of thin air. And so then I started getting really interested in film and then, you know, ultimately went to the Vancouver Film School because I was living just outside of Vancouver, BC. So, and so Kevin and I both just sort of independently end up getting in, we're in the same class. It was like the 25th, 26th, like they were numbered. So the school had just opened and we both went because our grades weren't that good. And so it was like, this is a tech school, right? You just go, it's 8 months, you're in and out. Kevin, so we arrived there together, we kind of become friends. But Kevin is the one who came with a plan. Like Kevin had already sort of, he was working in a convenience store and the video store back and forth. And so he kind of went there with the intention of like, I'm gonna learn how to make a movie and then go back and make the movie with my friends. And then we became friends. And so it became like around halfway through the program, it's like at the 4 month mark, it was like 10,000 all in. And I think at the halfway mark, it's like you had to put in your next 5,000. And Kevin was like, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to go home and get my job back. And you stay and finish the term out and learn how to learn whatever's left to learn. As far as like all that was really left in the back half of that 4 months was we switched into doing these sort of narrative 16 millimeter shorts. So you worked on like two, I think, or one. No, you just worked on one. And so Kevin left to save the money to put towards the movie. And then I stayed. And that's when Dave Klein was in our class, who was the cinematographer on Clerks. And we had kind of known each other, but as soon as Kevin left, like then Dave and I started hanging out a lot. And so by the time we graduated, so it was like March of 92, we start class, October we finish. And Dave and I are friends. And then after that, we started making like, there's a bunch of, you know, there's like a community of like people who'd gone to the school and they were making short films outside of the program. And so I was editing one, I was the editor on one and I was the dolly grip during the shoot. And I was cutting it at night and Dave had shot it. And so we were all just kind of around with Kevin in the meantime. I remember working on that short when I was the dolly grip for whatever reason. And that's when I read Inconvenience or the first draft of Clerks. So that was like probably November of 92. So we meet in March of 92. By November of 92, I have the draft for Clerks. And then from there, we were going to shoot earlier, but then there was a big flood and Kevin's like house was flooded and right. his car was flooded. And so he couldn't do it. And so we postponed it till March. And then I was prepping in the morning to rent equipment. Like I was getting up like really early at like 5 a.m. to call houses in New York to rent camera equipment. And And we had sort of talked to, you know, I mean, there's a lot of stories, but we had talked to, you know, we had talked to one DP who was in New York. He's an older guy who had his own patent lighting and et cetera, et cetera. And I remember Kevin and I was talking and like, this is totally, I mean, look, it all worked out. So, but I remember being like, I remember distinctly feeling like, oh man, like if there's that one guy who knows everything and we're just complete neophytes, it's like, it kind of, we both were a little bit like, it feels wrong, like, you know, or it feels like, it just felt like the wrong mood to have this person who was always like, you can't do that, and you have to do this, and you have to do that. I think we were just selfish and scared.
Ignorance. Ignorance was bliss.
Yeah, it truly was, like, kind of like, and then Dave, and we knew Dave, and we're like, well, let's have Dave, you know, let's bring a lot of people who know nothing together.
So, I mean, on paper, this sounds fantastic as an investment. So we were talking of, it's, I mean, it really does. Black and white movie about Clerks, no star power, cost about 27,000, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. First time DP, really. I mean, other than shorts, first time director, first time producer, first time cast, essentially. You had no first time. So again, on paper, solid investment.
Everyone lined up.
Everyone's just like, how much money do you need?
Yeah. We were like, he wanted to give us $1 million. And we're like, no.
Stop.
We only want 27,000.
Let's not get crazy. And then, and also I just recently found out that Dave was the DP on The Mandalorian. So he's done okay for himself.
Yeah. I mean, Dave, you know, Dave went on to shoot like most of the seasons of Homeland, and now he's on Mandalorian. Like, I mean, you know, yeah, he's sort of, you know, his career in the last has just taken off, you know, and he's doing, you know, he's been nominated for Emmys, like, it's just amazing. But yeah, we were at that point, you know, that's why Kevin ended up paying for it, you know, essentially all those on his credit cards. But, you know, his mindset, which always made sense to me, was like, you know, you can go to NYU, and if you'd gone to NYU or another sort of more prestigious film school, it's like you could have spent $100,000, $200,000. So it's like, you know, by the time he came out of Vancouver film school, having spent like, you know, $8,000 to $10,000 in fees and living and et cetera, et cetera. And then you add, you know, another $30,000 in credit card debt. It's like, it didn't seem, you know, it's like on paper, once again, like on paper, it was like, is this the worst thing? Like you, yes, you're in debt. And if the movie's a total disaster, you'll have to dig yourself out of it. But like, why not just jump in? I mean, but that's that. And I will say this, like that's, you know, that's not me. That was Kevin. Like Kevin's always had that drive, you know, and like to make that sort of like leap, you know, he made the leap of like, I'm just like, fuck it. Like, I'm just going to do it, you know, and like start racking up. Like giving credit cards,
you know, it's. I mean, look, I grew up in the '90s, and you guys were part of that first wave of true independent, like that. What we consider independent film today was created, starting in '89 with Sex Lies, and continued with Clerks and El Mariachi and Reservoir and that whole, you know, Linkletter and Slacker and all these guys, When you guys were making Clerks, it hadn't really hit yet. Sundance was Sundance, but it wasn't Sundance. Like, you guys helped create the mythos around Sundance with Clerks and Mariachi, and then of course all these other films that came around that time. So there wasn't even kind of a blueprint for what you guys were doing. Like, it wasn't like, oh yeah, we're going to submit to Sundance, and then obviously Harvey and Miramax is going to pick this up, and we're going to get a fat check, and our careers are blown. Like, that wasn't even a thing yet. So the risk that you guys were taking was not only crazy, looking in hindsight, it's like on paper it looked horrible, but it was really brave and stupid all at the same time.
100%. But I will sort of like, unfortunately, punch a hole.
please punch away.
Because there was actually like an absolute blueprint, which was Slacker.
You're right. I guess Slacker did. You're right. Slacker.
Slacker comes out. Kevin sees Slacker. Like, here's the Slacker blueprint. Kevin goes to New York, sees Slacker, goes, it loves it, and he's like, if that's a movie, I can make a movie, right? And then from there, there was like, you know, there was enough examples.
I guess you're right. We were really early, though.
Slacker, we were super early, and we definitely became like part of the sort of Sundance mythos of like the ultra low budget kind of like film from nowhere, you know, and then filmmaker plucked out and sort of, you know, given a career. Like, we're definitely all part of that. But there was enough, you know, right down to the fact that Kevin was like, there was an article about Slacker that he had framed on his wall, which was, Rick had made the movie and then showed it as a in-progress screening at the IFFM, which was the International Feature Film Market. And Amy Taubin did this sort of wrap-up article every year of and picked a few movies, and she had picked Slacker. And so that really was the blueprint. Like, Sundance was technically not the end zone. The end zone was to get to IFFM and screen it. So we had that blueprint, and then there was another article I remember written by Peter Broderick, which was a budget breakdown of Laws of Gravity, which had preceded us very, very like by a year, but it still was like, and so it kind of helped shape this idea of like, we think we can do this, because I think Slacker was 22,000 and Laws of Gravity was around there too. So it was like, it kind of became this sort of like $25,000 idea. That was the budget, you know? And before, you know, the other person who was like very influential, who had preceded everybody, was Jarmusch. Mm-hmm. You know, like, he, Stranger Than Paradise was a huge influence. I mean, like, a big influence as far as like long takes, you know. Like, there was definitely an influence, but it was also just an influence of like, you know, being young and like those are the first independent films that I think Stranger in Paradise was like the first indie film I
read. What was that? What year was that? What year was that? Is that 89, 90?
I thought it was 89. I was about to look.
Yeah, I think it's because I mean, obviously Soderbergh's, you know, Sex Lies was, but that was $1 million. That was like $1 million movie. So that wasn't a small indie, but it was the thing that kind of launched Sundance into being what Sundance essentially became. And prior to that, Hollywood Shuffle in 87, which was another big blueprint, which I think Robert Townsend doesn't get enough credit for being like one of the first guys. I think he was one of the first guys to put everything on his credit card and just say, screw it. And he,
yeah. And I think Kevin, the blueprint, I think that's why Kevin put it all on his credit card. It's like, it was like the blueprint was sort of like Hollywood Shuffle, Slacker. Laws of Gravity was just the first budget I'd ever seen, where they'd broken it down into camera equipment and all that stuff. And I was just like such a neophyte that I was like, it just gave me something where I was like, oh, like, so if somebody says a camera package costs three times as much, I could cry bullshit and go like, no, like, this, you know what I mean? It just gave me something to base it on. But we did have this sort of, we had this blueprint, and we ultimately go to the IFFM. We have a terrible screening, and no one's in the, like, there's us in the cast, and then there's like three or four other people, you know, but there's one guy, this guy, Robert Hawk, who was a consultant for Sundance and was a big part of the indie film world. And he had watched it, and he becomes this sort of like, he leaves and he tells Peter Broderick, and then Amy Taubin, who wrote the article, calls Peter Broderick and says like, is there anything I missed? And he's like, you got to watch this movie, Clerks. So then Kevin's in the store. We're all depressed because we're like, well, that's it. Right?
Like, that's 40 grand. Like,
yeah, the blueprint was over. The blueprint ran out.
We're like, we ran out. Done.
Yeah, we turned the page and we're like, fuck, it's blank. There's nothing left to do except lick our wounds. And then Amy Taubin calls Kevin at the store, and basically we become the sort of, if the Slacker article she wrote is the prototype, we basically become that film for that year. We became the film, you know, we became the Slacker of her article. and then everything just sort of ballooned from there. You know, everything was just like, and it was all, look, it's all, so much of it was word of mouth, because it was like from Peter Broderick, Amy Talbin, like it just became like Larry Kardash from MoMA, and then John Pierce, like it just, you know, then the film just starts, like, then people are moving, advancing things without us doing anything. And we're just sitting back, you know, like, watching like a, you know, roller coaster up like this. You're just like, what the fuck's happening?
And you're just along for the ride at that point.
Yeah. As soon as as soon as we get to Sundance, you know, the only thing left is like, will someone buy it? You know, we still didn't know that. And there had been sort of screenings prior, so some of the studios had seen it, and it was really like, well, we have to have really great screenings to see it. So that was the only thing kind of left. And then once it's bought, then it's truly like the roller coaster of, like, you know. But it was really it's something that the experience from beginning to end was so incredible. Like it was like it was written, you know, like by the time we're in Cannes in Critics Week and Kevin and I are like trying to avoid going to the awards dinner because we didn't want to dress up or some stupid shit. And then we go and we win, you know, and we're just sort of like, there's this amazing photo of us just sort of like, I mean, I think it's more on my back, but Kevin's face is just that, like,
what?
That holy shit moment of, like, you know, because you're constantly, your mind sort of adjusts to what happens. You go like, okay, we got it in Cannes and now it's over. Like, okay, we got the Sundance and now, you know, so you kind of go like, all right, like,
this can't keep going.
Yeah. Like the amazing train has, okay, the amazing train stopped here. Okay. This is great. This is amazing. And then it's like, it just kept going with that movie. It just had such a life of its own. And it was such an amazing sort of, you know, we flew around the world. It was just, and we were, I was 22, I think. So it was such, it was incredible. It was like, you know, and for years it was like, it has been, it will always be, it will always be this incredibly special experience that nothing can really touch, for reasons that aren't the fault of any other film I've ever worked on. It's just, you know, you can't re-experience something for the first time.
It's like your first love. Like you can't re-experience your first love. You might not end up with that person or whatever, but that moment and that time and your age and where you are in the world and your evolution and all that stuff, you'll never, ever get your first kiss. Like, that's something – you'll never get your first – so Clerks was essentially your first time.
it was the first time, and it was amazing. It was like we were in Cannes, and I remember there was a Miramax boat, and then next to it was this – was a yacht, and Simon Le Bon was on it. And basically we were running around all the time, but basically we end up meeting Simon Le Bon, and he's like, said, you know, he kind of says like, oh, I'd love to see a movie. And I was like, well, it's playing at like 8 a.m. or something crazy. And he's like, well, come get me. So I basically got up at 7:30, walked all the way to the, cause we were staying at a hotel. I walk onto his boat and no one's awake. So I rouse Simon Le Bon, who's like, and I take him to this, and I walk him into a screening, you know? It was just,
and he's like, that's bizarro world kind of stuff. Like, you can't even write that.
Yeah, exactly. It was just such an amazing experience. And there's been so many movies, you know, there's lots of great experiences, but it was, you know, it was being that young.
Right.
You know, and watching these doors open into a world. It's like, you can't, I mean, that's the thing, you know, you only walk through the door once. And that was like such an amazing experience of walking through the door into this sort of world that, you know, we generally are, you know, it's presented as, you know, behind a velvet rope, so to speak. So it's like, you only kind of get to walk in there once. And that was, you know, that was Clerks.
Now, the one thing that I want everyone listening, and I think this is an issue that I dealt with most of my filmmaking career. And I think a lot of filmmakers still do, is they'll look at stories like Clerks and Slacker and Mariachi and that kind of time period. And they will think, they'll make films today thinking that that's an option. Meaning like what would happen to you. Like I always consider you guys like a lottery ticket. Like you guys won a lottery ticket. It was the right place, right time, right product. And that goes along for all, like Slacker and Mariachi. Like if you guys show up today with Clerks, do you think you can cut through the noise?
I mean, it's hard to say. What I will say is like something always cuts through the noise, right? Like there's always something that cuts through the noise. And part of it is definitely luck and timing. You know, it's like part of it is luck and timing. Because, you know, as our career went on, like releases of movies is also about luck and timing too. You know, it's like you can sort of make a great movie and it gets released at a bad time with a bad marketing campaign. And it doesn't sort of like, I think could, you know, it's like, it's a time we're at right now. Do I think that a film like Clerks, well, it's like rated R comedy and all that's like, so much of that has grown since we've sort of come on the scene. And there's so many actors in that world that I do think it would be harder to cut through because what Kevin was like, whether people think he's the voice of a generation or like, I'm not arguing that point, but he was a voice from that generation that was unique and specific. And that's the thing that, in addition to luck, you know,
There's a combination. It's a formula. It's not just the one thing. It's a bunch of different things that hit together. I think
people who are, you know, people who are out there going like, you can't, if people look at Clerks or Slacker, it's not like Kevin looked at Slacker and was like, I'm going to make Slacker. He more was like, oh, that's a movie that's a vision from Rick Linklater. Like, you know, then Kevin was like, but this is what I find funny and this is what I enjoy doing. And he poured himself into that and had a unique voice. And, you know, I'll always say this, which is, you know, Kevin had been writing for years and years and years and years since he was really young. So by the time he's 22 and writes a script, it's like, it's just fucking better than, you know, everyone who's 18 is like, I'm going to write scripts. And then, you know, it's just cause I read those. I wrote those. Like I wrote, you know, I'm trying to write a script, but holy shit. Like this is, you know, cause I had Kevin who was just a much more developed narrative writer. He's just kind of new and you could see it on the page. So I think there's a lot of, you know, luck. Luck is so many things, but, you know, the pursuit of a unique voice, right? The goal shouldn't be like, what do I have? You know, like, or it's like, let's just make a movie. Like, let's make Clerks in a, you know, like valets. Let's make valets. And it's like, you can go ahead, but unless being a valet is this very personal thing where you can convey something to the audience that is unique, then you just become like a knockoff movie, you know? And I think like, I think when people sit there and go like, hey, let's make something cheap. It's like, well, make something cheap and personal. And that combination at least has the chance to cut through the right, because you're doing something that's like, you have to, and some people's personal, what's personal to them and what means something to them can be a $30,000 movie, or some people it's like a 40 million, like, you know, sometimes the scale of that can be, some people like sci-fi, like it doesn't really matter, but like I do think finding your voice is, and I'll bring it back to me, which is like, that experience of finding your voice was a much longer process for me. And then like, I, you know, Kevin walked in the door at like 22 and like, he had been developing his voice for years though. like he'd been writing school plays and stuff like that. But finding your voice, for me, is the most important thing that you can do. Like, that's the thing that people, like, finding your voice, finding that thing that's unique to you. If you can look at something in a way that no one else is necessarily expressing, there's other people who see it the same way. And if you can capture that, that's how you gain an audience, right? Like, we all look at things in different ways, but there's also just, like, I think what Clerks did, and this is, like, not anything I thought about when I was 21, but what I think it did was it created this sort of, you know, it was an expression of something that didn't exist. And there was this huge audience that was like, it does exist. This is how I talk to my, like, this is what we think is funny. This is when we bullshit with our friends. Like, and that's the part where it's like, there's all kinds of luck that has to come into it. There's all kinds of timing. And we as filmmakers, like, I believe what you have to focus on first and foremost is, like, what's the unique sort of perspective that you're bringing to what you're doing.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
That's a great, great, great piece of advice. You're absolutely right. If you can connect with something that's authentic to you in your own voice, if you try to go make another Clerks, you're going to fail because there's already a Clerks, and it was done authentically by Kevin and you. Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Now, after Clerks, obviously you guys are the toast of the town. You know, you're the belle of the ball. You're being wooed. It's the early 90s. Money is flying everywhere. And they say, what do you want to do next? And I and Kevin and you say, hey, let's do Mallrats. And you're like, here's those $1 million that you were talking about earlier. Now we'll accept your money. So you make Mallrats, which, by the way, I'm actually a very big fan of Mallrats. I actually saw it in the theater, test screening in the theater when I was in college. Oh, wow. And I got that little book, the movie, official movie book that they gave one to you as you walked out and stuff. Me and my friend were pissing ourselves when we saw it because it was speaking to us at that time in our lives.
Yeah.
So Mallrats didn't live up to the financial expectations of the studio. I didn't want to say it out loud. It bombed.
It totally bombed. I mean, look, the wounds of Mallrats have been healed, you know, a long time ago, knowing that, like, the audience ultimately found that movie and you know, it wasn't 1990, you know, when it came out, it was pretty dark. We were both like, fuck, because you put all that work into it. But
you guys were put in because you had one hit, which was Clerks, which was kind of like, all right, this is an anomaly. Let's see if these guys have anything else. So they give you a little bit of money and then Mallrats happens and it bombs. So that pretty much blacklists you in town, from my understanding. Like, it kind of just, you're in director jail and producer jail at this point.
It's the, you know, it's the sophomore slump. The reviews were terrible. You know, a lot of it sort of like pointed right at Kevin, I think, which was just like, you know, we built you up. We you know, we really set you out, and then you make this. And, you know, I think in hindsight, I would be curious if any critics would have the, you know, to go back and relook at that movie and understand its connection to Clerks, you know, like, understand that it's not this sort of, and I think for you as an audience member, like, you understood it, right? Like, it felt like a proper extension of what that movie was. But we were, you know, at that point, before it was over, Kevin had started writing a version of Chasing Amy that was a little bit more commercial. And as soon as it happens, it's like, I guess we were in movie jail, but in a way we lived in Jersey. So it was like, it's like when you're not in Hollywood,
you didn't feel the heat, if you will.
Yeah, you didn't feel anything. We were just kind of like more bummed out and like, oh shit, what do we do now? And Kevin was like, you know, like, let's just go make another movie, you know, and let's do it quickly. And so Chasing Amy became a reaction to all that money you know, that we were given, and the fact that it didn't do well, we're like, well, let's create something that we know we can get enough money. Let's do it cheap and also do it our way. You know, we kind of went back to, let's do it for enough money that we could be left alone and really be specific about what we're doing and not worry about, you know, casting, like we can cast who we want. So let's do it for, you know, shot the whole thing, you know,
like $100,000 or something like that, right?
It was like to shoot it and start cutting, you know, to deliver like a sort of a couple cuts of the movie and get it far along. It was like a couple $100,000. So there's a post cost and all the rest of it, but we did it, you know, we kind of went in at a price point that was like, we knew that it wasn't a huge investment for somebody. We could make our money back. You know, we were using like a great crew, you know, young people, and cause we were young too. I mean, I think I was 26 at that point. Mm-hmm. Young crew from New York, you know, was coming down. We were shooting all in Jersey. And then, you know, we were back to sort of a version of making Clerks again, just with a, you know, we took the experiences from Clerks, we took the experience from Mallrats, and sort of chasing Amy becomes the rebuilding year, you know, it becomes like, let's sort of like, we had other producers on Mallrats who we got along with, but it was like, this is like, all right, let's just do this our way. Like, yes, we need a bigger crew. Yes, we need this. Yes, we need that. But like, how do we do that through our filter and through the way we want to do things? And then from there, it's like after Chasing Amy, that's where we carry on through Dogma and everything else. But it was a really like, it was a refocus. That whole movie was just sort of like a shift back to like, all right, this is what we're doing.
And the smart thing that you guys did is that you moved so quickly, because Mallrats was, you know, you guys, there was a lot of eyeballs on you in town. They're like, oh, these guys, obviously they're a one hit wonder, you know, yeah. That's it. They're bubblegum. Let's move on. But you guys like, no, let's get in there. And arguably Chasing Amy is one of my favorite of the filmography of what you and Kevin have done. There's so much heart, so much authenticity in that film. It's not nearly as silly as Mallrats in the crudeness of it, but there still is those elements. But there's so much more heart in Chasing Amy. Like it's deeper in a way. Am I wrong on that?
No. I mean, I think Chasing Amy becomes the sort of I think a lot of people react to it because it becomes the sort of the movie that sort of represents kind of more the totality of who Kevin is, right? So it's like the crude humor, of course, is part of it. But it's like, you know, he's also he's a dramatist. He's also somebody who's like has a big heart. And, you know, it's also a personal movie, you know, it's a personal movie for him. And I think that sort of shifts, you know, sort of Clerks and Mallrats, and this becomes something where he's like, all right, I'm going to tell another personal story, which, you know, just happens to be more grounded in, you know, there's a lot more drama and real drama, right? So it's like sort of drama stemming from this specific situation. But I think it became like, and that was a year late. So Mallrats comes out in 95, 96, like February or something. We start shooting Chasing Amy, February or March, and then January 97, we're in Sundance, you know, we're back, you know.
We're back, baby. And that does gangbusters at the box office, especially for its budget, and launches this little known actor, really Ben Affleck, which is his first starring role and that whole thing. So it was just an exciting time because I was following you guys, like I was following you and Robert and Quentin and all that, you know, that crew and Richard and all that crew. I would watch every damn thing you guys put out, and it was that weird time. And I always tell people this, like the 90s, it felt like every month there was a new Cinderella story. It's either John Singleton, it's Ed Burns, it's Kevin Smith. It was like it was an amazing time to be an independent filmmaker. It was kind of like when Spielberg and Lucas and Milius and Coppola and De Palma, that film school brats generation when they were kind of given the keys to Hollywood because Hollywood had no idea what the hell to do. So they're like, here, go make Taxi Driver. And you guys kind of had that run in the 90s. It was that from like 89 to like 98, 99, there was that run that was just so many amazing filmmakers came out during that time.
I mean, I think there's, you know, I'm sure someone's read a book about it, but I feel like, you know, part of it is like the industry sort of needs to open, you know, sort of like, especially then it's like, nowadays it feels like there's a lot of venues and ways to get things made. And back then it was like, it was just harder to get things made because there weren't as many outlets. But you also see the surge of, you know, Fox Searchlight. So there's more sort of like, there's more outlets for these movies. There's more opportunities. But also it felt like the like in the 70s, the business was kind of like, how do we make
money?
Yeah. Like, what do audiences want? Like, you know, there's also a generational thing to me, which is like the industry has to open its doors every once in a while to let in the new generation of voices that they don't necessarily understand. You know, like what was happening in the 70s, it's like, it's not like those guys who were making movies in the 50s and 60s necessarily understood like that the audience wanted to see Easy Rider, right?
Like, right. Easy Rider kind of opened the door for all those guys to like, they said, wait a minute, this $200,000+ movie went on and made like, you know, $10 million or whatever it made. They were just like, we don't know what the hell's going on. Let's give it to these guys, the Scorsese and the Spielberg kid. Let's give them that shark movie.
it's like audiences change. You know, I think it's always like some combination of, you know, audiences are changing and, you know, younger people come up and it's happening now. Like there's, you know, I'm almost 50, so it's not like I'm the young buck anymore. And there's a whole generation of people coming up that have been influenced by totally different people. And, you know, they've all had the internet since they were born. Like, all of these influences change what people's tastes. So it's like, I think in the 90s, there was a sense of like, coming out of the 80s, it was like this need of like fresh voices and, you know, something that was more reflective of the generation coming up.
The Gen X guys, you know, we're Gen X guys. That generation was like, it was the 90s were fun, man. The 90s were fun. I miss them more now than ever before. When you could just go to a movie theater, that was nice.
Yeah. Well, that was like last year.
Yeah, I know, right?
You didn't have to go all the way back to the 90s, but yeah, the 90s were, we had a lot, you know, I had a lot of fun in the 90s. It's funny, no one ever talks about the 2000s.
You know, like you never hear like, oh, the 2000s music. Like, no, you know, I know those songs and I know those films, but the 80s and 90s get in the 70s, 80s and 90s kind of get that. They have their own thing. But the 2000s is tough. And like the 2010s was another.
But is it just that it's too young?
I don't know. Oh, no, don't worry. It'll come back around. Like right now we're in our 90s nostalgia. And I think now people are starting to kick into the early 2000s. It's like a two-decade run because remember when the 80s was like all the rage, like everything was 80s, 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 and 80s is still 80s is still cool to a certain extent. But I remember when it was 70s, like in the 90s, the 70s were kind of like a thing, and there's like a 2 to 3 decade delay.
Well, I think we're old enough where it's like at a certain point, like we're not nostalgic. I like part of it is because like you and I will probably never have nostalgia for the 2000s, right? Because we were just too old. Right. Like once you hit 30 or whatever, it feels like you sort of cease being, you know, it's like you stop like living in this, or you stop reflecting back in nostalgic terms. Like
you're right.
The 80s, I was going, like I graduated from high school in 89. So the 80s was like when, you know, the movies and music, you're sort of, what I think is like the 80s for me, the 80s and 90s was this explosion of I'm ingesting massive amounts of art in the form of movies, music, photography, like everything. Like the 80s and 90s, like I would fucking watch like four movies a day.
Yep.
Like it's this massive period where you're taking things in, partly because, you know, you're not great or you have an outlet to like put things out. So you're sort of like, you're amassing all this stuff. And so I think that's why it has such a strong influence on who we are. Like, I think back to the 80s and 90s, and yeah, like I, like everything I do today, it's like, it feels a little bit referential to that time, but part of it is because like, that is when the synapses were really forming around like, and these sort of large touchstones like land in your head during that period. And then by the time I get to 2000, like I don't have all these sort of cultural touchstones of like, you know, I was, of course, I was listening to music and watching movies. I was doing all that stuff. And there's great movies from that period, great music and all that stuff. But it's still like, it doesn't have the same sheen to it because it wasn't during that sort of explosive period of like, you know, getting your driver's license and kissing, like everything's new. You know what I mean?
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Now, there's a couple of, there's a few films that you produced that I had, I mean, I'd heard of a couple of them, but I didn't, when I started doing research, I actually went into it and there was a group of four features that you produced: Vulgar, Drawing Flies, A Better Place, and The Big Helium Dog.
Yes.
I, you know, I've seen some of Big Helium Dog, which was shot on like VHS. I'd like out of Beta. Like, what was that shot?
I think they were all shot on 16 millimeter.
Really? Yeah. They were all shot because I guess the copy that I saw was so bad. Yeah. That it looked like you shot it on video. I'm like, why did they shoot this on video? This makes no sense. But the other ones were shot on 16. So, you know, some of the people in that, like you had the Broken Lizard guys, you had Q from Impractical Jokers and Baba Booey, Brian Lynch, all this, these amazing people. Tell us, can you tell me just a little bit about those four movies? And because they were kind of in a small, they were in a short period of time that they were all made.
It was after, I think it was after Chasing Amy. And we had sort of signed a deal with Miramax, like an overall deal. And part of what we threw in was like, hey, we want to make these micro budget movies. It sort of in a way to sort of like, our career was sort of, the movies were getting bigger, you know, the budgets were getting bigger. And we were like, well, hey, let's sort of, with some of the people we know that have scripts that they're writing and stuff, like, let's go make some of these micro budget things in the 20, 25 range, basically clerk's budget. I feel like we got $100,000 to make four movies. And we sort of, and then the relationships was, you know, Brian Lynch, had worked on Chasing Amy. Vincent Pereira had been around since Clerks, who directed A Better Place. And then Vulgar Brian Johnson was Kevin's friend for a long time. So all these movies just became an extension of that moment. We were like, oh, well, let's go sort of make some of these movies. And, you know, and it did, it happened within like a two or three year period, you know, and Brian was the one who knew the Broken Lizard guys and, or, you know, he kind of had connections to them, and Brian Quinn had just worked at the office. So like he had worked. Even where I was talking to him the other day, like we've known each other for like 25 years. He had sort of come in to work at the office. Like he was in charge of, like back in 99, if you got a t-shirt sent in the mail, it was Brian Quinn who did it. You know, like that's where he was.
And he was working at VSQ.
Yeah, he was working at VSQ at that time. And so all the people we kind of knew, and it was like, you know, we loved independent film, and so we were like, let's go make some of these movies. And they're all very different, you know. And Vulgar got into Toronto, and they all had various degrees of success. And then I think it was like, my memory of like, why didn't we keep doing it, was it was almost too much work.
Like, I mean, making a movie is not easy.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's not like we were on set all the time, and I think it was just a matter of like, we made Dogma, so we're heading into Dogma, and then the Clerks cartoon's happening, and it's just like the amount of work we're doing is expanding, and then suddenly like to maintain those or to keep them going just felt too much work. But it was really fun, you know.
And now, is it true that there is just no copies of Big Helium Dog anywhere?
I mean, Brian Lynch has one.
But no, I just saw an interview say, but he doesn't have one. He said it didn't happen.
I'll ask him, but as far as I know,
he has a copy of it, but it's not been released. But it's not available anymore.
It's never been released, and I can't remember why. There was some clearance issue, but it was never released. Now the rest of them were.
It has a hell of a cast. It has a hell of a cast. Now
I don't know what happened to it. It was like it was off and on through the years. It was like music clearances, or there was something that was sort of hanging over its head, and it just never sort of. I thought he must have a copy somewhere.
I have to believe. I mean, he's a director. Yeah. He's got to have at least a VHS copy of it. Or
now it's like fucking Raiders of the Lost Ark to find the thing.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't know. It might be. I'm sure, like, or View Askew or somewhere, there's got to be a copy. I do not have a copy. So
One day it will get leaked online, just like Deadpool did accidentally. Now you also got involved with another little known film as a producer called Good Will Hunting, and that was one of my favorite films of that time period. And how did you get involved with that, and how did you like kind of was it Ben that brought you in on that?
So we were on Mallrats. We met Ben, and at that time. We were aware of who he was because, like, the whole saga of Good Will Hunting was in the trades, where they had sold, like, Ben and Matt had sold the script to Castle Rock for a bunch of money. So it's like, you know, other young guys, like, sell script for a lot of money. And so it was on our radar. And then through Mallrats, we became friends. And my memory is that, like, during that period, we met Matt during a sort of internal screening on Mallrats. But basically what we found out is that Castle Rock was going to put it into turnaround because the guys were attached, but they wanted to attach a director that the guys weren't excited about. So basically there was a big turnaround cost. And they sent us the script, and we really loved it. And we had just signed our overall deal at Miramax. And so we sent it to our executive, John Gordon, and we were like, this is fucking great. You guys should make this. Like, you should meet with the guys. There's a turnaround cost, but you guys should act fast and dive all over it. And so it happened really quickly. And that's, you know, our job. We really were just like, we had just signed a deal. So we became a sort of conduit to get it there, hype it up and get everybody excited. And then it happened really quickly. So by the time Chasing Amy happens, all of that was done. Like basically the movie was at Miramax, and they were doing rewrites. And they were also like I remember like meeting with directors, you know, there was like before, like they wanted Gus to do it because they had met Gus and Gus wanted to do it. But then it was like Michael Mann and a couple other directors.
Michael Mann's Good Will Hunting would have been a very interesting, there might've been a couple more guns, just a couple.
There would have just been all guns. But yeah,
there would have been a shootout with Will Hunting, which is that great sequel, Good Will Hunting 2, Hunting Season from Jane Silent Bob Strikes Back. What a great
Michael Mann version in a totally different way. But it was, and then we, you know, sort of, and then once it's in the hands of Gus Van Sant, it's like you're sort of just, you know, then you just get to be a fly on the wall. So we were up there a couple times. We were shooting in Toronto, and it was just, you know, it was really interesting. I mean, for me, it was really interesting to watch because you're working so much. You're not on this, you know, you don't go on the sets of other filmmakers. And it's sort of interesting to watch how people act in different ways. Like he's very quiet and sort of, you know, he's not sort of sitting at the monitor shouting. Like he sort of directs in this more sort of quiet way. That film was like, I remember seeing we went into New York to see like the director's cut or whatever. And it was like, I mean, like it was basically 95% of what the movie ended up being. Like it was just so like he just knew what he wanted it to be, and it was so specific, and like it was just incredible. Like I remember just being, you know, you had chills. You're just like, wow, like
so good, man. That movie's just so good.
Yeah.
Now during this time, I think you were heading into Dogma. Did you guys know that this was going to be as controversial as it essentially became?
We knew in the sense that, you know, at that point, Miramax was owned by Disney, and Disney was like, you know, we're not going to let you make this movie. So it's like, it wasn't like we kind of entered into it. The writing was on the wall a little bit from the very beginning, that like there was a real like
problem.
That there was a problem. And then it kind of grew from there, and then kind of like, you know, peaked at a certain point and didn't kind of get worse or didn't get better or worse. It just sort of, you know, there was pickets at the New York Film Festival and pickets when the movie, you know, picketing or when the movie came out. But
yeah, I actually remember seeing Kevin going out to picket with them. And like, who's this bastard who made this movie? It was brilliant to watch.
Yeah, he went out and he protested.
He protested his own film.
Yeah, it was great. But yeah, it was. We kind of knew enough to, you know, we had a fake name for the movie while we were making it, and you know, nothing really came of it. But there was definitely like a tension about it before, early on. And it was, I mean, look, was it a surprise to us? Like, we were like, what's the big deal? Yeah, but enough people at that point were like, you got to take it more seriously. And so, but
you're playing with fire. You're playing with fire, guys. Just be aware of what's going on. Don't be completely ignorant of what's happening.
I mean, part of me is just like, it never really got that bad. And I couldn't imagine if, you know, today.
Oh my God. Can you imagine if Dogma showed up today?
Like, I think that just, you know, partly with social media and all the rest of it, it would just be, I mean, that's part of the thing too, where it's like, even a protest has to like be ignited, right? It needs fuel. And I think like it was still 1998, and it's like, there just wasn't the, you know, it was still just like people, like 10 people in front of a movie theater, and everyone's just driving home going like, oh,
whatever. Yeah. Imagine Facebook around that time, or Twitter or something like that would have exploded.
It would certainly, the key is like a few people can make a lot of noise now. And, you know, and I think back then it was way harder to do. So it's just sort of the momentum of what happened around the release, it just kind of was like, it was kind of gone very quickly.
Now, another film that you produced, Jersey Curl, was unlike anything I'd ever seen in the sense of the attention that you guys were getting, like while the movie was being made, because of Ben and Jennifer's relationship, or Bennifer as they like to call it. I mean, the pressure of you guys as the filmmakers must have been like, dude, I just want to make a movie. And it all of a sudden turns into this thing that it's not even about. Like, it's about Jennifer, and we got to cut Jennifer out of it now because she had this thing with Julie or the other thing that they, so like, you got caught up in this kind of tsunami that was not even your fault or even initiated by you. You guys got just caught up in the Bennifer tsunami. How do you deal with that, being like in the center of a hurricane like that, when you, Kevin, were dealing with that?
You know, ultimately, like with everything in life, it's like you get to a point where you're just like, well, there's nothing we can do about it. It's like, there's nothing you can do about it. At the time when we started the movie, it's like, their relationship just started. So on one level, you're like, well, this could be great for the movie, right? Like, there's no, you don't know either way. And then by the time we get to the test screen, it's just obviously not going to be beneficial to the movie, because people had such a strong opinion of the two of them that it, you know, transferred onto the movie itself. And then it was kind of after the first test screening where, like, well, there's nothing we can do. You know, it's like, there's really nothing we can do. It's like, the audience is not going to be enamored with this. And so, like, it did become about trying to, and look, you don't want to be in that situation. You know, you don't want to be sort of fueled by or be making creative decisions based on just sort of like a negative response that your audience has to the actual individuals and not the characters. But you also, you know, there's nothing you can do. It's like, once you're sitting in it, and it was enough. It wasn't like there was two people. It wasn't like there was like a couple that like were like, we fucking hate those guys. It was like it was palpable. You're like, all right, like we can keep testing this thing. And it wasn't like, no, there's going to be a whole other audience. It was like, we love them and we hate them. It wasn't even like, it was just like, generally people were like, we don't want to necessarily watch this. And so, you know, you try to pivot off of that and try to maintain, you know, the story you want to tell as best as possible. But, you know, ultimately it's going on in the theater. Ultimately an audience is going to, and if it's keeping the audience, unfortunately it's like, you know, it's not what the movie's about. So you're like,
right.
If it's keeping the audience from sort of interacting with, or sort of being receptive to, you know, what the heart of the movie is, then, you know, you have to make that decision of like, start to trim that part of the movie down and get into the sort of the rest of it. And so it was definitely frustrating, but, you know, I tend to believe like the energy you spend battling things you just have no control over is just, you know, a lot of wasted energy. And
that is words of an almost 50-year-old man saying that. And I completely understand what you're saying, because there's just stuff when you just can't get until you hit a certain age or experiences in your life.
It's like there's that great saying of like, worrying is paying debt on money you don't owe.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
That's great line. Great line. Yeah.
And that's, you know, it's like, and you can apply that to like worrying about things that you have absolutely no control over is paying debt on money you don't owe. Like you're just grinding in this sort of thing. And look, we were younger back then, so I can probably impart these ideas because like you go through enough experiences where you're like, oh wow, like, there really was nothing we could do. Like, That component of the movie was this exterior issue,
right,
that existed outside of us. We couldn't reach into it, and like we couldn't recut their public persona, right? Like
that was the thing about it, is because a lot of times when there's controversy in the film, like Dogma was generated by you guys. Like that's just the nature of the story. And there was a you know, controversy and all of that stuff. And even Zach and Miri Make a Porno, that had some controversy to it because it had the word porno in it. Like it freaked people out. But again, generated by you guys. But this was out of your control. Like it was completely exterior. And I think also people were just so exhausted of seeing those two together. We're just like, we don't want to see a movie with these two now. Like it was just so much. And you guys just got caught up in that wake.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's for every, look, Hollywood, you know, couples in Hollywood getting together making movies has been an incredible publicity benefit, and it's been a bad one. And it's like it's not like we came to that moment. If we'd all come to that moment and they were like, every time two stars are in a movie together like this, it's a disaster, then obviously there would have been enough people in the room going like, don't do it. But it wasn't that. It was like, there's cases in both sides. It's like, it could either be a boon or it could be bad. It's like,
it could be Mr. and Mrs. Smith, you know, with,
yeah, exactly.
Which was exactly the same kind of Brangelina and that whole thing. And it was, but it fed it. It fed that movie. And this one, it just sucked and hurt the movie. It was just really weird.
Got to a place, and by the time the movie comes out, it's like, there hasn't been a sort of turn, but basically from the time we started moving on, it's like, you know, the public is fickle and they'll sort of change their mind. And so they change their mind, and like, and you sort of sit in the test screen and go like, all right, you know, like, what are we going to, like, there's nothing we can do. We can be mad at, like, it was hard. You couldn't really focus your ire on anybody either. I mean, you could try, but once again, it was like, it was just that situation.
It's Don Quixote essentially hitting the windmill at that point. You're like, there's nothing you can do.
There's nothing we can do. Like I said, we couldn't. If we had the ability to go in and reshape the public persona to make it all good again, we could have done that and kept the movie the way it is. But we couldn't do that. The only thing we could control is the content in the movie, sort of you know, trim back their sort of relationship at the beginning of the movie,
but it ages well. Like, you watch that movie now, it's aged very, very well because you're so far removed from that ridiculousness that now the movie can live on its own. So it's, I was just always curious about that.
And the movie is ultimately about him and his daughter. You know, it's about him and his daughter. That's what the movie is about. And so, you know, it ultimately, like you said, it sort of, I think there's probably I don't think even trimming back some of the beginning stuff was the end of the world. I think there's probably like another version of the movie that's more of like a, you know, maybe a slightly extended opening, maybe putting some of the stuff back in there. But I think overall it's like, you know, it didn't sort of break the movie. Let's put it that way.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, you know, we've been talking all about you producing and making, you know, Viewaskew kind of films and all that kind of stuff. But then out of left field, almost, I start seeing that you're writing Freebirds and getting involved with that and then directing The Grinch, co-directing The Grinch. And how the hell did you get into animation? And like, how did that work around town when you walked in? Like, I think you were saying, like, aren't you the Clerks guy? Like, why are you in animation now?
I was gonna go to art school or film school, so the sort of I always was doodling and drawing and I was really like, before I was really debating whether to go to art school or film school right at the moment that I ended up making a decision, go to Vancouver film school and meet Kevin. Like, it's that fast. And I didn't know what to do. And I was living near UCLA. My grades weren't good enough to go there, but I was living in these sort of like shitty apartments there. And I used to run around the campus. Like, I would do two or three runs around the entire campus. And then sometimes I'd cut through the middle and there were these big stairs where they shot Gotcha. Like, there were these big stairs right in the middle of the thing. And I would run up the stairs. And I was running and I was like, what am I going to do? And I run up the stairs and it was nighttime. I would run at night after I was working. And I get to the top of the stairs and there's really bright light in my face. And so I kind of like slow down and adjust, and they were shooting a movie. And I was like, that was it. Like, I was like, wow. You know, I was, my decision was sort of made in that moment. And then basically I very quickly applied to the Vancouver Film School, and five months later from that moment, I'm up in Vancouver and I meet Kevin, like, after that sort of moment. But the art part, you know, the art thing was always in my head.
So in other words, if an animation cell would have fell out of a window and hit you in the head, you might have never gone on that ride.
There's a life drawing class up there. I'd have been like, oh my God, like, this is what I should do.
It's a sign. It's a sign.
And so I go to film, but I'd always been interested in it. And I've always loved animation. But the big moment was, I remember Kevin and I, because Jason Lee got to see The Incredibles before it came out. And it was like, and it was a special screening. And, you know, I loved animation, and, you know, I thought that Toy Story, and I'd already sort of like, I was really interested in this sort of new technology applied to this sort of classical 2Ds. And so I saw that screening though, and that was the thing where I was like, oh, I want to do, like, I'd really love to do this, because it felt like, oh, this is a movie. Like, it really felt like a movie. It was like, it's an animated movie, but the camera work, the performances, like, it just felt like, oh, you could just make a movie. Like, you could do what Crane shot, like, you could do whatever you wanted. Like, you had all the filmmaking tools inside of this box, you know? And from there, and I remember telling Kevin, like, I think I left there and I was like, I want to do that. Like, I want to get under the hood of that and sort of do it. And so coming off of Zach and Mary, it was kind of the moment where I was like, if I'm going to do it, I just got to do it. Like, I got to sort of stop. I could do this forever. This is comfortable. And, you know, but for me, I was like, I just have to stop and sort of, you know, rebuild myself, like refocus myself specifically on animation and writing too. And like, I stopped after Zach and Miri and was just kind of like focusing on writing and trying to get into animation. And that's when, this guy, Aaron Warner, I knew, and then it just, and then it becomes like, you're in the business long enough and you know enough people. And if you've sort of, if you're fun to work, if you're good to work with, if you work hard, like, you know, all that stuff can pay off. I'll say that, which is Freebirds becomes this guy, Aaron Warner, who produced all the Shreks, was like, I have this movie, Freebirds. It was called Turkeys at the time. And he was like, you know, if you want to learn animation, like, this thing's like a fast moving train. And if you're willing to sort of like jump onto it, you'll learn very quickly. And so I was like, as the producer, and I was like, yeah, I was like, this is my shot, you know? Because at that point, it's like now it's like animation, making animated films is a much broader sort of, there's more opportunities. But at that point, it was like, you know, this is the beginning of everything opening up. And that, you know, that was more like Pixar and Blue Sky. Like, there was these established studios, and if you had an idea, you had to go to those specific places, and that was it. So then I jumped on Freebirds, and just through the process of making it, you know, it's a very open, collaborative sort of medium. It's a little, you know, it's a little bit different from making live action, because it's just the pace of it's different. It's just a much more open forum. You know, you're sort of making it you're getting together with a bunch of artists, coming up with ideas. And so I started writing pages, and those are getting, you know, brought in. And so then I come off of Freebirds, and I don't want to do animation. I was like, I don't know if I want to do animation. And so, because I was tired, it was just tough.
Yeah, because you produced and wrote as well.
Yeah, it was a tough schedule. And so I came off, and I was like, I'm not sure. I was like, I loved a lot of it and the people I worked with, but I was like, I'm not sure if I want to do it. And then I was just working as an editor, you know, which I've done through the years. And I cut a documentary on Marvel that was on ABC called From Pulp to Pop. Mm-hmm. It was like, so I did that. And then I was cutting, I was just doing a little polish. I wasn't the main editor. I was just there for the end of a movie called, it ultimately became called No Escape, but it was called The Coup with Owen Wilson and Pierce Brosnan. It's by the Dowdle brothers, mm-hmm. who just did the Waco series. And like, I had known them. And, my friend was the editor, and I was like, oh, I'll get on that. And then that's when I got emailed from Chris Melendondri emailed me, and I didn't know him. And I was like, well, I don't understand why I'm getting an email from him. But once again, so Brian Lynch, who was the craft service guy on Chasing Amy and done all these other things, you know, he wrote Minions and, but he wrote Hop. So he'd been working in Illumination for a while, and he had given me, or he had given Chris my information. And Chris was like, hey, cause Illumination at that point was like, they were making more movies. And so it was like, as opposed to one every two or three years, they were trying to do, you know, two a year, like they were just, and he was feeling like, maybe I'll bring in for the first time, like a producer, like an independent producer to help me sort of manage projects. And once again, I was like, I don't know. I'm not sure if I want to do animation. And the Dowdle brothers were just like, the edit room that we're in was like a block and a half from Chris's office. And they were like, dude, like, what the fuck? Like, go walk down the block. And I was like, all right. So I went, and then Chris and I hit it off really well. And we met three or four times. And then we met a couple times before The Grinch came up. And then he showed me some artwork. It had been going on at that point for 6-7 months or whatever. And so we went back and forth. And then finally I was like, yeah. Like I really got along with him well. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to do it. So then
that
happens.
It's so funny because when you talk, as you're talking, a lot of filmmakers listening, a lot of times they think, oh, it's about the agent, or it's about the manager, or about, you know, this or that. And it's about relationships. I mean, seriously, the craft service guy who, if you would have been a dick to,
yes,
would have never recommended you for that job. Because you never know where anyone's going to be. And I've had that happen to me in my career where they were my interns and then they all go off and are directing movies and have, you know, all these, this amazing career. It's so remarkable that just the craft service guy, what is it, 15 years later, 20 years later, something
like that. It's like 24 or 5 years later. And I had kept in touch with Brian. Sure. Like, you know, he'd send me scripts and I'd read them and we'd kept in touch. But yeah, that was, you know,
about relationships.
Yeah, that was the seed of it, of like, that someone like Chris was like, knew Brian and was like, trust his opinion. And then he's like, who do you know that might be good about? And I had come off of Freebird, so I ultimately had some experience at that. Right. So I was like, I had some experience. And I was even honest with Chris. I was like, I honestly don't know if I want to do animation.
It's the worst job interview ever.
Oh, I was really like, I don't know if I want to get into this, but like I said, I really kind of got on with him. And then, you know, when he finally brought up the Grinch, I was torn too, because, you know, I love the Chuck Jones version. Mm-hmm. I grew up with that. And so I was like, oh man, like, I don't know if I want to be the guy to fuck this up.
I don't want to be the guy that screws up the Grinch.
Yeah, like I was like, if it was just the book, it's like at least you're like, oh, you know, like he didn't do a good adaptation. But it was like there was a lot of things for it. There's the beloved Chuck Jones classic, which was in me too. But, you know, then I was like, but it's a really cool opportunity to sort of build out a different version of it and also, you know, build a bigger world. You know, that was like part of what we were doing, is like, oh, we get to really explore Whoville and really expand on it and make this sort of a more expansive, experiential movie of it. So,
and it did okay at the box office. Did okay.
It did. It ultimately did well. Yeah.
About half a billion, according to IMDb Pro. So not bad for a job you didn't want.
You know, the credit goes to so many people.
Sure.
That's what's so much fun with animation is it's like there's so many incredible artists from, you know, layout to, you know, animators to, you know, the sort of concept artists and art directors and the vocal talent. Like there's so many people. That's the greatest thing of animation is like, you know, it's like you spend years and years and years. And just when you're like about to shoot yourself going like, I have to fucking look at another storyboard, you know, it's like, then you start to see like, then it's like right when you're there, it's like you start animating. And then right when you're sort of like going like, oh, they start lighting and rendering. And like, it's like right when you're sort of getting tired and going like, when do we get to see the final? And, you know, right when you're just sort of desperate to see final images. They always seem to pop up and you go like, oh, okay, this is why we're doing it. Cause it's like, it does just look incredible. It's like when you get to sit in dailies and see the finished stuff, you're just like, it's just so amazing. You know?
That's,
but it's like, you have to be patient.
No, it's, and now it's a system. I mean, when they were coming up, you know, when Disney Animation was kind of setting it all up, they didn't even know what they were doing, but like now there's a system. And I have a good buddy of mine that worked at Disney for 12 years as an animator. He did environments. He was a lead in environments, and I would go into Disney Animation and I'd walk around and I'd see the different departments and I'm just like in awe. It's just in awe of what you could do. And as a director, because I know this, they did this at Disney Animation, is they would have a board up and they would give the directors a stack of cash, of like paper cash, and they would have all the sequences of the movie up and they go, you can put money on what sequences you want to spend a little extra money on, but this is all the money you get. So they would get to choose like this action sequence I want a lot more attention to, as opposed to just let's kind of get it through. And does anything like that happen? That was just a Disney thing.
That definitely did not happen, because I would have just walked out with the money.
You're like, I'm done. I'm out.
Yeah. I'm like, I'm going to put it in my pocket. And
it was fake. Know. Scott, it was fake money. It was fake.
Yeah. We could talk about this later, but I'm going to take my wife's not too much. No, we didn't do that. I mean, you know, it's something that, but those conversations are sort of collective.
Right.
You know, you're sort of, and you know, I mean, to me, it's just something you inherently know, whether it's a live action movie or a.
Right.
Or an animated movie, you're sitting there going like, hey, we have limited resources, we have limited money, we have limited time. So it's like, you know, and in animation too, there's that sense of like, well, if you want this sequence to be freaking huge, then you better get going now, right? Because there's a pipeline, there's a moment where it's like with the movie, it's just like, it's cut off. It's like, you can't add new shots, they won't make it through in time. So, you know, there's a lot of thought constantly put into it of going like, oh, this is, you know, we want to do a big shot here. Like, we were doing there's a big, huge, like, kind of drone crane shot in Grinch where we're, like, going through this pond of people skating and then all the way up to, like, so you have to sort of, like, get all that stuff arranged because all the, you know, it's basically live action. You know, you have to sort of make sure that you've made those decisions to be like, oh, we want to set the tone here and want to do that here. And part of that has more to do with just like making movies with financial limitations, you know,
right.
Which is most people. I mean, there are people who don't, you know, there are filmmakers who are given the sort of do whatever they want. And I don't necessarily like, I mean, nobody's offering me that.
These are not problems you or I have.
Yeah, this is not a problem that I have, and I don't think it's a problem that I'll face. But I do think the limitation is those limitations can be really, really. It helps you. For me, it just helps you focus on the story,
right?
And go like, hey, like you better know what's important, you know, or you better figure it the fuck out really quickly because you are in charge of like trying to argue why people should, you know, we need more assets, we need this, we need that. If you're the person who's going to be driving and pushing for things, like, you know, the limitations will help you figure it out because you go like, all right, like we can reduce the amount of shots here, we can do this here, we don't need that many extras there, like we can make that choice because like, you know, I really want this to look like this, or I want this to sort of exist there. So, you know, but no, nobody came around with cash.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Now, I just have a few questions I ask all my guests, some like a rapid fire. If you could go back to your younger self, what would you tell him?
Somebody else asked me this recently. Not to, you know, like call you unoriginal.
You know, Scott, I'm quite offended. No, it's okay.
Somebody just asked me this and, you know, it's probably more insight in the way my brain works. Is like, I take it so literally. I'm like, I don't think I would say anything. I don't know what I would say. I don't know what could, because everything I know every like conclusion I've reached that has any value in my life is because of the experiences I went through, you know. Right. And I think you could go back to your younger self and be like, you know, buy Apple. I guess that would be
yeah. Buy Apple at $7. Buy Apple at $7. Like, buy Facebook at $30.
You have $3,000 from your car sale. I know this won't make any sense, but buy Apple.
No, buy it. In 2021, there's going to be a GameStop. Buy GameStop.
Yeah. It would probably be that. Like, as opposed to giving me any fucking advice of like how your career. Because here's the thing, like, my career in a way makes no sense, even to me. Right. Like, it's not like there's no linear line. Like, I can't point to it and tell somebody, like,
this is what I did. You should do this.
Yeah. It's just like, I followed my curiosity, which is what I do now. You know, I still just sort of go, I'm driven by my curiosity of like animation or this or that. And I kind of like, which is why my IMDb page is kind of a weird mishmash of producing and documentaries. And, you know, like I love documentaries. Like I'll go in that direction. Like, you know, I sort of follow, I'm not like I make horror movies or I make, you know, rated R comedies. Like I just love, from the time I was a kid, like I just love film. I mean, my sort of taste in music is the same as in film, which is really diverse. I just watch a lot of different things. And so,
yeah, I mean, honestly, at the end of the day, you know, I try to hack the whole, like, what's the path I can take? Okay, should I try to do what Kevin did? No. Okay, maybe what I do what Robert did? No. Okay, maybe what I do with Richard Link? Like, and I'm not the only filmmaker. We all do that. Like, at one point, you know, you start looking at other people. Like, you guys were doing it with Richard. You guys were doing it with Slacker. Like, literally, that was what you were trying to do. But at the end of the day, it's a lot of luck, right place, right time. Like, you happen to run into Kevin Smith. You two happen to gel. He happened to have a script about Clerks, and then off you go. And it happened in the early 90s when that was a fertile ground for something like that to kind of take off. Like you said, would that, if it would happen in 85, is there a,
I don't know.
Does it happen in 2005? But, you know, I always tell people this, like if Robert shows up with El Mariachi today, I'm not sure he breaks through with El Mariachi today. But in 91, a $7,000 action movie shot on 16 was exactly what the industry needed. It was the proof, like, oh my God, someone made a movie for $7,000, or the story they sold, at least.
I think if Robert was, if you, you know, to me, like, if you transplanted, like, the $7,000 version of El Mariachi that Robert would have made would have been very, very different.
So, with today's tech, you're right.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right.
He couldn't calculate that he could have sort of done it because, like,
yeah,
there's like the thing that I still go back to, and you know, it's not about people's career paths. Are look, it is about who you know, making connections, like meeting people, having like a deep sort of list of people that you know, people that are making movies. I mean, it starts in film school. Like, if you know enough people, you're working on shorts. And, like, it doesn't even matter if the short's very good. You're just trying to get experience, right? Like, that's, like, you're a good worker. You work hard. You can fucking push a dolly, whatever. Like, for me, like, that's a big part of it. But I also think, like, and this is specific to people who want to be writers, you know, writer, directors and stuff like that. I think it's, like, you know, the thing, it goes back to having that unique voice. Like, what what's the story that only you can tell, you know? And at the end of the day, like, El Mariachi, Slacker is, like, very, like, all those guys had one thing in common, which is they really wanted to tell that story. Not because they really wanted to tell that story. And not because it was the cheap idea. That, to me, is, like, always, like, people are, like,
yeah.
Well, I really want to make this, but they're like, but then I, you know, I came up with a cheap idea. It's like, well, no. Like, come up with ideas. And, like, if all your ideas are $80 million, then you might have a problem.
But, it's like,
yeah, but like, if your passion isn't in these cheap ideas, like, everyone's going to know it.
You're absolutely, you know, I've never really, I really never quantified it the way you stated, because you're absolutely right. Like, you know, when I make my movies, you know, the ones that sing are the ones that I really wanted to do. And the ones that were like, I'm going to try to be this guy, or this is going to get me to that next level, or this is going to be the one that gets me the agent or the man. They fall flat, you know, and the ones that have all the passion and the voice are the ones that people really connect to. And that's something that filmmakers trying to break in today really don't get. And that is the thing that will cut through. You're absolutely right. That is the thing that will cut through all the noise.
Well, because if you have to go talk about the movie you're making, you know, that's the simplest part of the equation. It's like, if you're passionate about it for hours, you know, if you made it as some sort of vehicle, I mean, the amount of people I've known through the years, like, well, I'm doing this, but what I really want to do is that. And I was like, I get it. But I was like, you have to find, like, everything should be an extension of your passion. You can do things just to learn, right? those are the two levels. If you want to go make a film that you're just like, because you can afford to do it and learn and become a better director or become a better whatever, there's value in that, right? But you have to know that the end result of that is that you learned. You know, if you want to, the other reason to make somebody is like, what are you fucking excited about? Like, what are you passionate about? Like, what kind of stories are you passionate about? Like, is it, you know, like if you love horror movies, then it's like, that's great. But what's the personal version of a horror movie? You know, I mean, if you look at Jordan Peele, it's like, that's why those movies are fucking amazing, because they're personal. Like, it's not, he didn't invent horror. He basically was like, but this is my perspective of what a horror movie is.
Right.
And suddenly everyone's like, holy shit. Like, you are the only version of you. And I'm not saying you're a unique snowflake, but you.
We're all unique snowflakes.
Your perception or your take or your sort of joke on, like if you throw something on a table and everyone makes a joke, like there'll be 10 different jokes, right? Like that's what makes you different. And the more you sort of push yourself to find that, and that to me is like, was a very long process. Like I, at 21, like I did not have a voice. Like I, like, and it was, having Kevin was like such a great, that was part of the benefit of standing next to Kevin, is because I was like, that's what a voice is. Like, that's what it means. That's what it means to have a voice. That's what it means to cut through the noise, right? Because all the rest of it is noise. And so I was very aware of how long it would sort of take me to develop my own voice. Like the whole time I was like going like, that's a voice, right? Kevin's a voice. Like no one can argue that. You may not like the voice, but the motherfucker has got his own voice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a million people, the Coen brothers, like all, yeah. You know, like.
Richard Linklater, all those guys. Yeah, they all have a voice. You're absolutely right. Even Robert, who makes those kind of action. And but that's his voice inside all those movies.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. Now back to the show.
You can learn how to edit, you can learn all the technical stuff, and all that stuff is smart. Like that's basically just making you better at your job. If you want to tell your story, if you want to be a writer director, you know, you really have to find your, the most important thing you do is find your voice.
Two last questions. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Find your voice.
Next question.
To find your voice. And like part of the reason about finding your voice is that through the process of finding your voice, what you will do is create confidence in what your voice is. You know, it's like there's all these positives that come towards really taking a deep dive and be like, what kind of stories do I want to tell? Like, what do I get emotional when I watch? Like, what do I want to recreate on the screen? Like, you know, some of those basic questions of like, oh, when I watch, like, I love to make people piss their pants laughing. I like to make people shit their pants. I'm fucking like,
scary.
Like, if these are all the, like, we're all here because we're like, movies make us, movies evoke emotions. They make us feel things. And I really, like for me, part of the process was going like, well, what are the things that I love to feel when I'm watching a movie? And therefore, that's the thing that I want to recreate in my own movies. And so locating that, like, you know, what's the thing that you're like, oh, fuck, like when I go watch a movie and like, I'm terrified. Like I just walk away and I'm like, I'm joyous. I'm so excited. If that's it, then you should focus on that. Like, if you're like, no, I love to make people feel like life is worth, you know, like I like to make people cry. I don't, you know, like all those things exist. And it's sort of, it's almost like finding your voice to me is more about focusing on like, what's the emotions that you like to evoke in the kind of content you're making. Because that's part of like what will help you fill out the kind of stories you want to tell, which is like, what's the emotional impact you're looking for? Anger, rage, love, like all of those things. Like those are the things to sort of think about. So yeah, finding my voice was like probably the biggest thing.
And three of your favorite films of all time.
I mean, there's so many. I'll just sort of rattle some off. I'll go way back to the beginning. Like Time Bandits is a huge.
That's so good. Terry Gilliam.
Such a huge. The ones that, like, you know, for me, it's always like ones that shift your perception about, you know, what a film is, are the ones that really stick in my mind. And there's tons of amazing movies that don't necessarily do that. But like Time Bandits was a big one for me. Raising Arizona was another one, like really early on, where I was like, I just ate it up. And, you know, and then, man, I can go on and on. I mean, like Fight Club is a one later on in life where I was like, so completely just like, fuck.
What am I doing?
Yeah. Just like, fuck, I want to walk. Like, and then I just watch it like 100 times, but you know, 8.5 was another like,
right,
just mind blowing sort of experience from like, you know, we're in that space. You're like, this is a movie. Like, that was the exciting part about being young, is like, you're constantly like watching so many things, and that experience of being like, wait, I'm constantly redefining what a movie is through everything I'm watching. Like, that's the sort of, those are the movies, and like Time Bandits, Raising Arizona, 8.5, and Fight Club is one where I was like, fuck, I was sort of being like, oh, okay. Like I'm kind of pivoting and going like, this is a movie.
I mean, I've had Jim, who wrote Fight Club, on the show, and I just geeked out with him and Fincher, and basically anything Fincher does, you just walk by and just like, what are we doing, really? I mean, yeah. And I've talked to some amazing filmmakers, and anytime Fincher comes up, they just say, it's like, I don't even know what we're doing here. it's having one of those, like, it's like Kubrick, when Kubrick would pop out with a movie, just like, what am I doing?
Yeah, 100%.
Scott, man, thank you so much for being on the show, brother. It has been an absolute pleasure talking to you, man. And I wish you nothing but success exploring your new wants and things that excite you wherever you go. And I hope that IMDb account gets a little bit more broad and crazy.
Me too. Thanks for having me.
I want to truly thank Scott for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe. Thank you again, Scott. It is because of Scott and Kevin that I am here as an independent filmmaker. They were an amazing inspiration to not only me, but to a generation and generations of independent filmmakers. So Scott, I tip my hat to you. Thank you, my friend. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/453. And if you haven't already, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com, subscribe to the podcast, and leave a good review for the show. It really, really helps us out a lot. Thank you again for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.